Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey there, EB5 Investment Voice listener. After over 100 episodes, we're going to try something a little different this time. You probably already noticed that the show length for this episode is over an hour. And that's not the only thing that's going to make this one stand apart. This time, we are doing an entire panel with four experts on COVID-19's impact on EB5. One of those impacts is everybody recording this from their own home location. So please give us a little bit of leeway on some of their audio quality. The information is fantastic, but people understandably sound a little different than they have the previous times they've appeared on the show. Our first panelist is Ron Clasco. Ron heads the E2 and EB5 investors team at Clasco Immigration Law Partners, where they have represented thousands of investors, over 50 regional centers, and many U.S. developers. Ron currently chairs the American Immigration Lawyers Association Administrative Litigation Task Force. He has also served five terms as a chair of AILA's EB5 committee and has won the AILA Founders Award two times. This is Ron's second time on EB5 Investment Voice. Our next panelist is Carolyn Lee. Carolyn has represented regional centers, developers, funds, and investors for over a decade, helping U.S. project clients raise $2.5 billion in EB5 capital. She's also the current chair of American Immigration Lawyers Association National EB5 Committee, and she is also the new chair of IIUSA's Public Policy Committee, as well as serves as their legislative counsel. This is Carolyn's second time on EB5 Investment Voice. Our next panelist is Jeff Carr. Jeff is the president and senior economist at Economic and Policy Resources, Inc. With 35 years as an analyst, he has helped develop EB5 project business plans in 45 states and completed more than 225 economic impact studies. Jeff has also completed dozens of direct EB5 project assessments, analysis to establish targeted employment areas, and has drafted numerous regional center business operation plans. This will be Jeff's fourth time on EB5 Investment Voice. And our panel moderator needs no introduction because she has done 110 episodes of EB5 Investment Voice. And that is Mona Shaw. Take it away, Mona.
Thank you, Mark. Welcome, everybody. Welcome, Ron. Welcome, Carolyn. Welcome, Jeff.
Great to be here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Delighted to be here.
Well, I know we're all still in our complete shutdown phase, and this complete shutdown of businesses has obviously left many of our EB5 clients in quite a worry. I know that you all are getting this spate of anxious emails.
Absolutely, and not surprisingly.
Yeah. The investors' worry is really twofold. One, what if the jobs can't be created? And of two, return of their capital. But with this whole COVID-19, there is a lot of other impacts on EB5, which I think the average investor probably wouldn't know about. So I thought it would be a good idea if we could discuss all of these. Carolyn, we're hearing about force majeure a lot, that this is a force majeure and how will the force majeure issue really impact us? Can you just explain to our viewers, what are we talking about?
Sure. And I'm going to try to give it an immigration gloss because, of course, the force majeure concept, it's a contractual principle. It's a doctrine that applies to parties' performance obligations in the commercial context, typically. And it refers to massive events that are beyond the party's control. And examples can include things like natural disasters and labor strikes and acts of government and wars and the like. We're seeing a lot in terms of the commercial litigators and attorneys and business actors talking about this concept and clause in their agreements, whether or not they're obligated to perform under COVID-19 lockdown and delay conditions. Now, where it comes up in the immigration and specifically EB-5 context is in, of course, the context of EB-5 project progress. So where there is a stoppage of work or delay in construction, say, or in normal business operations, so that we've got a reduction in operational revenues. And of course, this is of great concern to us in the EB-5 space because this invokes material change and the possibility of a material change in the project, and also the possibility of delay in job creation and possibly no job creation or not as much job creation as would be needed for all the investors.
Wow, all in very important details. Ron, don't you remember when we had Superstorm Sandy? There were a whole bunch of projects in New York City which were delayed because they couldn't get even the licensing for or all their permits for some time.
Yeah, that's, I sure do remember that. I think in every case involved with Superstorm Sandy, we were able to resolve any issues that arose. This, I think, is a whole different level because we're now dealing with a pandemic, the effects of which will affect not specific businesses, but the entire country and the entire world for what will probably be more than a year. So I think that Superstorm Sandy gives us a little bit of background, but I think we're really dealing with something totally unprecedented in our since we've had an EB-5 law.
Right. Well, the jury is still out as to whether it will be a year or more. They were suggesting it'll be up to 2022. I think until they get a vaccine, I think we are going to see a number of changes to certain industries. Jeff, you had just mentioned before we came on the podcast that you see certain industries being out for some time.
Yeah, Mona, I think the speed, the breathtaking speed in which things have come apart in the economy now because of the COVID-19 pandemic have hit particularly hard the leisure and hospitality industry. When we talk about leisure and hospitality, we're referring to things like hotels, restaurants, entertainment venues, which comprise about one in every 10 jobs in the U.S. economy. And that's almost 17 million jobs in total.
I would say that also one in 10 EB-5 projects are hospitality also.
That's true. They represent about 8.5% of the total consumer spending in the country, which is about $1.3 trillion worth. And essentially, many of those establishments in that category have basically been shut down in order to help stem the tide of the pandemic spread. Yeah, but that's very difficult on those workers. That's going to be very difficult on the owners of the projects, particularly those that have EB-5 financing, because this is going to make it difficult perhaps for them to hit their job targets on the plan that they initially laid out in the investors' initial I-526 petitions.
So if we have a project which is a hospitality and they decide they're going to, in order to stay afloat, maybe not hospitality, maybe it's something else within that industry, and they really change their model, Ron, that's a material change, right?
No, not necessarily right. The reason it's not necessarily right is because there is no actual definition of material change, and there is no mention of material change in the EB-5 law. So we're dealing with a rather amorphous EB-5 policy of the Immigration Service without any specific definition. We have very successfully argued in virtually every case where there's been changes that A, it's not a material change, and B, it's irrelevant if it's a material change. So if the end result is that because of COVID, our model is going to have to be different. In my opinion, it's probably a very good chance of being able to show that a business, what I've said before is a business plan is not a statute. Every business plan, EB-5 or non-EB-5, is going to change, especially when you have a program where normal processing times on 526 is maybe 4 years. Of course, a business is going to change. And of course, if there's a change in circumstances of the city, state, country, or world, it has to adapt. So I think a strong case can be made in that it's not a material change. Now, even if the government believes it's a material change, it's very important to understand that there's a difference between the USCIS policy manual, which is not the law, but the Immigration Service policy, and what the law says.
Ron, I should actually just interrupt you just here, because then we might have a listener on who really doesn't understand what we mean by a material change and the way it really affects an EB-5 petition. Carolyn, perhaps you could briefly explain and then Ron could continue.
Absolutely. This is a creature of policy, as Ron just said. It's not in the statute or even the regulations. And it came down by memo in December of 2009. This memo said that if after the filing of an I-526 petition, the business plan experiences, quote unquote, material change, that pending I-526 petition must be denied. And moreover, if the 526 petition is approved, then that approval is subject to revocation. And that policy never defined what material change is. It did refer to a couple of AAO decisions, precedent AAO decisions, matter of Caddick-Back and matter of Izumi, which is a specifically EB-5 AAO case. And it used those as authorities to base the material change policy. But as I've argued in a couple of different contexts, that's very flawed legal foundation on which to rest this policy.
Yeah, we often describe material changes when somebody asks us or if in a petition as something that may make the investor not invest within that petition. If it's something that really is not going to make too much difference to the overall adjudication, perhaps something like the TEA or the TEA wouldn't change or the size of the building wouldn't change, then it's arguably perhaps not a material change.
Yeah, in the end, if the end result of the change is that the necessary jobs are going to be created, I think there's a reasonably good argument that you can make that it's not a material change. And Carolyn raised an important point. She talked about the cases that were the basis for this Immigration Service material change policy. And what those cases say is that if you have a project that was not approvable at the time you filed a petition, and you got your place in line based on a project that was not approvable, you can't make a change to then make it approvable. And there is a legal basis for that position. But what we're talking about in most of these discussions of material change is we filed an I-526 petition for a project that was completely approvable when it was filed. And now a change is being made and it's still completely approvable. That has nothing to do with the law that is the basis for the material change policy. So we always take the position, if the project was approvable when filed, the fact that there's a change should not be considered legally relevant. The Immigration Service has adopted that for changes that occur after the investor becomes a conditional resident. They originally didn't agree with that.
Yeah.
But they changed their position to agree with that. I believe we will see in the future, probably as a result of litigation on this subject when it comes up, that if you have an approved I-526 petition, which means that the original project was approvable and it's now being changed to still be approvable, I do believe there's a good chance of getting a court and ultimately the Immigration Service to agree that that should not be considered a material change under the law.
Ron, spoken like a lawyer, that we talk about going to court. Don't you think this time USCIS might just agree without having to go to court? Perhaps if we write them a nice letter?
I don't know if there was ever a time for that, but I can tell you I was involved in a litigation that resulted in them changing their position to agree that a change after someone's a conditional resident is not a material change or has no impact on the investor. They did not agree with that. The only point they agreed with that is as a result of litigation in California.
Yeah.
And I expect the same thing will happen at least for issues of changes after I-526s are approved. And I believe it should be after I-526s are filed.
There will be a huge amount of discretion allowed in this also, because like everything else, you are going to get that occasional project or that occasional lawyer who is going to misuse this whole material change COVID-19 issue. I'm sure we're going to see that.
Yeah, it's probably true.
Jeff, do you think that this whole COVID-19 is going to change the existing TEA, which could play into the whole material change issue?
That's a good question. Just when we thought that we had calmed down a little bit on the TEA issue after the implementations in November 21st, 2019 regs, we get this dramatic change in labor market conditions that I think are going to change the way people think about TEAs, not necessarily change anything in the regulations or those kinds of things, but probably change the way people think about TEAs because, you know, we had a long run, a more than 10-year period, over 120 months, where the only thing that we were worried about for high unemployment rate TEAs, those are the TEAs that use the rate of unemployment in metro areas, was whether or not in our small area that we had designed for our TEA territory, how the unemployment rate in that smaller territory moved relative to the U.S. average in order to maintain 150% of the U.S. average differential. And so we spent a lot of time, you know, helping folks understand what was going on as they were raising their EB-5 capital, because a lot of times raising the EB-5 capital, particularly for a lot of the larger projects, was a multiple year thing. And TEAs of the high unemployment rate variety that are in the areas, metro areas across the country, have to be updated every year when the new labor market data comes out and gets apportioned to the little census tracts that are out there that comprise a lot of these sub-municipal areas in the metro areas that we call high unemployment rate TEAs. The speed in which people have lost their jobs, beginning about in mid-March, when you consider we've had 22 million people apply for unemployment insurance benefits over the last 4 weeks, we're going to go from a national unemployment rate of about 3.5% in February, which was a 50-year low, to something well into the double digits if those people translate into people that are counted as unemployed. And so we're going to be looking at a national unemployment rate that's going to be higher than any of us have experienced in our professional careers. And that goes for everybody that's done an EB-5 project. Now, the good news is this is going to be a national unemployment rate that's going to be calculated for 2020. That's not going to govern TEA certifications until next year about this time.
When do you expect the new data to be published, Jeff?
Well, the data for 2019 is starting to be published now. I think COVID-19 is slowing that down a little bit because we're getting ready to take a look at all the high unemployment rate TEAs that we have for the 2019 U.S. and sub-municipal data that should be coming out. It's in the middle of April. Usually that's when we start to look at all these things when they become available. And so there's going to be a lag time for this large increase and jump in the U.S. unemployment rate that's going to move the TEA unemployment rate up, 50% higher than a 10% unemployment rate. If it was up that high or even high single digits, is a number that's pretty high in the way people are going to think about it. And so for projects, the few projects that are out raising capital now, hopefully they can wrap it up before they have to deal with this once we get the reading on the 2019 and make sure that they're going okay.
So Jeff, just stop there for a second. I have a situation that I want to throw at Carolyn and Ron. This is something which could actually genuinely happen. As you know, people are struggling right now. They can't pay their leases. They might lose their lease, or rather the landlord kicks them out because they find somebody else who can pay that lease. Now, suddenly the same project has gets some more, an influx of money, and they find a new location around the corner. Let's say it's just a franchise of some sort. Now that this new location is around the corner, it is actually a different TEA. Is this going to be considered material change? I'm not talking about the investment capital. Say it's a higher TEA and they can bring that money in, but would that material change mean that the whole petition would be, had to be refiled?
Yeah, I sure can't tell you for sure how the Immigration Service would deal with it, but I can tell you how we would present it, and I think we would likely be successful.
Love your
confidence.
That's
probably more
Ron.
Material.
Yeah.
Goes without saying.
Right.
We presented an application which involves an investment in a TEA that is going to create a certain number of jobs, which meets all of the statutory and regulatory requirements. Obviously, it's taken a while for the Immigration Service to even look at this thing. Now we are still in the same situation. We're still investing $500,000 in a business, in a TEA that will create the necessary number of jobs. The fact that we moved across the street in terms of what's material to the approvability of the application, we would argue it's not. When I discuss this, it's always important to understand the way I talk here is not necessarily the way I'm talking to a client. When this happens, I'm going to explain to the client, this could be a problem.
Yeah.
But here's how we're going to solve the problem. So could it be a problem? Yes. Could Immigration Service raise it as an issue? Yes. Do I think we'd have a good chance of being successful rebutting it? Yes.
Carolyn, I know we don't like to talk too much about speculation, but I'm going to now speculate that EB-5 has been considered, or is being considered rather, as part of the stimulus packet. And if it comes into the latest stimulus packet, say 3 or 4, the TEA is all over the place. And the law is that your petition is, as upon the date of filing, it has to be a TEA on the date of filing. Bearing in mind what Jeff has just said, do you think there's an opportunity or there's a chance that Congress or USCIS might allow petitions to be filed without any TEA? Or do you think they're going to really still go out and ask us to prove it's a TEA under the new rules?
I just want to make sure I understand the question and concern, Mona. So are we talking about, say, a petition being filed in 2021 when we have to work with very high national unemployment rates for 2020?
Exactly. Because this question has been posed to us several times. Will the TEA still be the same when they've all changed?
Yeah, I mean, the current standard is, under the statute, 150% of the national average. I don't think we've seen many signs that the current USCIS leadership is likely to be flexible in its interpretation of the statute. And of course, that could change, or I might be shortchanging them. And, you know, these are extraordinary times. But I do tend to think that it's a statutory matter. So we're really going to need Congress to give us a fix. And this is the perfect opportunity, right? We've got COVID-4 under discussion.
Yeah.
Heavens, we've been talking about legislation for the last 4.5 years. So,
yeah. I can't see this coming as the forefront, though, I'm afraid. I will have to admit, I feel that if anything, Congress are going to talk about integrity before they do anything else. But I do see EB-5 as coming as part of the stimulus. It's not just being a speculation alone. Ron, do you have anything to add on that?
Well, here we're all somewhat guessing.
Yeah, that's why we use the term speculation.
Right. I would be less optimistic than you are, Mona, that we will see legislation either standalone or as part of COVID legislation that would address EB-5. I think that EB-5 remains a hot potato and EB-5 is still immigration. And anything with the word immigration in it that gets tied into a COVID bill, I think will make the COVID bill more controversial than they want to make it. So if I'm speculating, I'm betting on the under.
Jeff, any thoughts?
I'm probably right in the middle of everyone. I could see this happening or being proposed by friends. Whether or not it actually traverses the whole gambit of the legislative process, I'm probably with Ron a little bit on the under. And part of the reason I say that is that, you know, part of the November 21st regulations on TEAs were designed to make rural TEA projects more attractive to people. And it just kind of seems to me that, you know, the run up in the national unemployment rate and the concern that people are going to have about the small area, whether it was able to keep pace enough to keep a 50% higher distance between it and the national average, it's all by itself making rural projects more attractive. And the people that were behind the regulations, that was their entire intent with tightening up the TEA rules and making it harder for projects to qualify for a high unemployment rate TEA. So
yeah, I do hear you, but and this is I know we're going a little off track here, but that hey, this is what a podcast is about. It's a discussion. But the point is that if a city like New York City or Chicago or any of the big ones have really been hurt by COVID and they suffer unemployment, that ripple effect hurts far more than anything else. So surely it makes sense to give the strength back to these big cities.
Well, that you're right. That's where the economic activity is. There's more activity in downtown Manhattan than probably any other real estate in the entire country. You have to balance that, though, I think a little bit with, if they use the $2.2 trillion bill sending the aid where it was needed, they didn't do a very good job of that either. Mm.
Congress could keep the 150% standard and write in something that takes into account extraordinary situations like what we're experiencing, except in the event where the national unemployment rate exceeds 15%, something like that. That way, you're keeping intact the 150% standard, but also recognizing that, you don't necessarily want to limit high unemployment TEAs to 40 areas with 40% unemployment. So there are fixes like that that are doable that won't be controversial, but it's just a matter of whether or not it can be slated in with the other priorities.
Carve-outs are possible. We're in a era where there's really no playbook for what to do about this.
There isn't, but discretion is still there. The rules on discretion are still there. And I think that if we can bring as many positive attributes that we can to the whole exercise, the better.
And I'll just say that the urban side of the EB-5 equation has been a powerful voice on the Hill. I wouldn't rule out, even if there's no legislative change with COVID-4 or subsequent legislation related to COVID relief, that if we see these disparate impacts as a result of massively high unemployment in EB-5 TEA treatment, that there's going to be an outcry for a fix.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Carolyn. And if you recall, back in 2007 and 2008, that's when really EB-5 really jumped. In fact, if you recall, and I've brought this up many, many times, construction and real estate, which has really taken over the EB-5 industry, wasn't even on the cards because construction jobs weren't considered permanent jobs. It was only after Senator Cornyn wrote a letter to USCIS and they changed a few rules that they allowed projects to consider construction jobs as to be permanent jobs.
That's right. I remember visiting projects at a standstill, and EB-5 really certainly turned those projects around.
Yeah, that's right. Back in 2008, you actually started EB-5 right at the very beginning, Carolyn, at that time, I remember.
Launched my career in EB-5 for sure.
Ron was there way before, but we started around that time.
And it sounds like it really impacts what Jeff Carr does with the economic impacts.
There is a difference between the cause of the Great Recession and the one that we're in right now. There were financial imbalances and then there was credit constraints that came out of the real estate collapse and subsequent banking crisis, which caused lots of projects, even big projects, to look for non-traditional forms of financing. And EB-5 did march in at that particular point in time to help fill that void. This time, the catalyst was the pandemic. The financial system is really well capitalized right now. Obviously, people who are applying for credit are a lot risky now than they were even 90 days ago. And there are some issues with some financial markets right now, but the Fed really has stepped up its game and has provided liquidity to the system. So the system isn't quite as starved as liquidity as it was in the financial crisis that happened in the mid-2000s to late 2000s. But nevertheless, EB-5 is what economists refer to as being countercyclical. The harder it is for projects to find financing, the more attractive the EB-5 option becomes to folks that are looking to put together a capital stack in order to execute on the project.
Right. But right now, what is really needed is job creation. But before we actually get into that, I did want to ask Ron. Ron, we're going to see this. We're going to have projects which are not going to be able to create their jobs. And rather than talk about construction job, which can be delayed and the construction jobs can come later, I'm going to talk about the little jobs, the little entrepreneurial type of projects where they just cannot afford 10 employees.
Sure. So we've been talking about the hospitality industry. I think, dealing with a restaurant as an example is probably a very good one. First of all, there are a lot of direct EB-5 projects at a restaurant. And secondly, they're as affected as anyone by the COVID virus. And maybe the best way to look at it is to look at the three or four examples quickly. You have situations where you have restaurants that were funded with EB-5 money, and they were doing well. All of the jobs were created. And then along came March and April of 2020. You know, let's assume they're hanging on, they're doing takeout or delivery or whatever, and they're down from 20 employees to 3 employees. In those types of cases, you can still be successful because the issue is not do the jobs exist when the I-829 is being adjudicated. The issue is were the jobs created, past tense. Originally, the Immigration Service did not agree with this, but ultimately they do agree with that. So that's the first example, and that's how we would address that. Should I go into 3 or 4 examples or discuss each example separately?
Give us another example.
So another example would be where we have all of the positions that were created in the restaurant. We're not in the situation, in the first example, we may never bring back those jobs. We may never come close to reaching 10 jobs or 20 jobs again.
Right.
And that's, you can still deal with that for the reason I said. In the second example, I had 10 jobs, and during this time, 3 people have left. They got sick. The business went down or whatever. But I still expect to have those 10 jobs. Well, then you get involved in the issue of the fact that we're dealing not really with jobs, but with positions. So unlike the first example, in the second example, that restaurant still has 10 positions, even though only 7 of them are filled.
All right. I have another take on that restaurant with the 10 positions. Carolyn, 3 of those positions which were filled pre-COVID, suddenly they cannot afford to have the full-time employees there. And let's say 3 or 4 of the positions are cleaners. And instead they decided, the cleaners go out and say, look, we don't want to take W-2s. We still want to work for you, but we want you to give us a 1099 for a while so we can get, a feet on the ground, because as a 1099, you're going to take less taxes off us, et cetera, et cetera. And this is seriously happening. But the control of the employer is there. The employer is buying the cleaners, the equipment, they're buying the cleaners, the mops and the buckets and the stuff, and they're telling the cleaners what to do, where to go. The cleaners are not going to 10 different restaurants. They're only cleaning that one restaurant, but they're getting paid a 1099 and not a W-2. In my view, that is still an employee as far as EB-5 is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly make that argument. I mean, I would make all the arguments. Number one, you had created the 10 jobs related to the EB-5 investment, and not all of them might be there at the time of A-29 filing, but that's irrelevant because under policy, you get credit for the jobs as created, number one. Number two, Ron's argument that 10 positions still exist. Number three, yes, they're 1099, but the statute and regulations refer to employer-employee, and elsewhere in the regulations, it refers to the control test. So, if you think you can meet IRS's standard, then you might be able to argue successfully that despite 1099s, they are actually employees. And the fourth would be the reasonable period of time. I would be strategic about whether or not you roll out that argument at the outset, because the concern would that somehow detract from fully asserting the argument that all 10 jobs or positions are already there. But one still has that reasonable period of time argument, certainly. And that is where the language force majeure is specifically used in policy.
Yeah, very good point. So I have another scenario for you all. In the regional center context, so we now have a project which raised all its capital back in November of last year, and it's under construction. Now, they don't have that same kind of capital income anymore at this point, or the banks are hooing and hawing and not giving them the same amount of construction loan. So they change. They change their model to be a slightly smaller position. So they're using less money. And Jeff, as we're using less money, there's going to be less jobs, right? What do they do there?
Well, usually people don't raise up until their absolute limit. You know, for example, if they say they're going to build a building and they're spending enough money to, for example, create 100 jobs, just to be simple with the math, most of the time they won't push it all the way to the upper limit in terms of the number of their jobs, divide the number of employees by 10 for 10 investors. They usually, because everybody understands that this kind of situation happens occasionally, it's going to particularly happen while the economy is going through what it's going through now. That's why usually the marketplace won't allow you to raise, you know, the amount of EB-5 capital by taking the jobs that you create by your plan and dividing it by 10 to get the number of investors. Usually they want 20 or 30% of a surplus marketing position because they realize, so for example, they'd only allow you to raise money from 7 investors in a 30% cushion or 8 investors instead of the 10 that the number of jobs would support, because they realize that this kind of thing can happen. I'd usually tell people that when, if you have a construction budget, you want to be somewhat conservative in it, that you want to have a really high probability that you're going to spend at least that much. In the past, you know, the past 5 to 10 years, you know, usually with the way that construction material prices have been going, people find that they usually spend much more than they anticipate in their budget, and that this hasn't been a problem. But clearly you can deal with that in two ways: by being conservative in your construction expenditure estimates, which you give the economists to calculate the jobs. And then if it allows you to raise money from 10 investors or 20 investors, maybe do 2 or 3 less per every 10 investors than you would be able to do if you conform specifically to the regulations for just a situation like this.
Ron, do you have any comments here?
Well, actually, what I was hoping to do is comment on the point that Carolyn raised about the reasonable time. It's interesting there in terms of how that plays out. So Carolyn appropriately talked about that this is an important issue, that you have under the Immigration Service policy a reasonable time to create the jobs. And the Immigration Service policy manual says when you file the 829, you have to present the fact that within 3 years of the person becoming a conditional resident, all of the necessary jobs are projected to be created unless there's what they call extreme circumstances. Now, if, you know, we have clients who are, you know, in the situation where they're going to be filing 829s now, and it may be very difficult in the COVID era to be able to realistically and credibly meet that test. And what we do on those is we cite not to the USCIS policy that says it has to be within 3 years of becoming a conditional resident, which basically means within 1 year after the 829 is filed and long before the 829 is adjudicated. That's their policy. But under the regulation, it says that at the time that they're adjudicating the application, which very often may be about 3 years after the 829 is filed, that at the time the adjudicator is adjudicating that application, 3 years after the 829 is filed, the adjudicator has to determine whether the jobs will be created within a reasonable time after the adjudication, which if it's being adjudicated after 3 years, you may have to show, you know, 4 years instead of what the Immigration Service said.
They're not really giving us room on that. You know, we're seeing RFEs where they're just not giving us the time, the additional time. But perhaps after the COVID-19 incident, then they may have to.
Yeah. And no matter what the RFE says, we always give them what the law is. And they don't necessarily issue decisions saying, we agree with you on what the law is, but they usually don't want to fight it. And that is, in fact, what the law says. It's not even a question. And so they usually just approve it.
Well, I think that the time frame for job creation is also impacted by COVID-19 related impacts. As your audience members may know, Mona, USCIS by policy has a time period of 2.5 years after I-526 petition approval for completed job creation. And, you know, this is not in statute regulations, it's by policy, but that is the test at the moment. And so,
but sorry to interrupt you here, Carolyn. This is what we're not seeing. If a petition is taking 2 to 3 years to adjudicate and suddenly comes out now and they're saying, well, you were supposed to have had these jobs created according to your timeline about 2 years ago. And here we are 2 and 3 years later and the jobs aren't created. This is what we are seeing on petitions.
I agree with that. So I think what you're saying is, look, we're getting these RFEs on petitions that are pending, which is not an application, obviously, of their 2.5 years after 526 petition approval. So in that instance, the argument there on the services side is this might be a material change, because in those RFEs, the examiner will refer to the timeline stated in the 526 business plan. But the issue is the same, which is you're going to have an impact on the timeline for job creation, whether it's deviation from the one that's in the 526 business plan or according to 2.5 year standard from the 526 petition approval. And, you know, this situation is potentially exacerbated by the fact that we're seeing reported reduction in 526 processing times. Now, when you look at the reported processing times, you're going to see something ridiculous, like 50 months for 526 petitions, which is a problem. But it is being reported that they're actually taking less than that, and in fact, less time than in the last few fiscal years. Plus, you add to that the new processing changes that were recently announced and in theory in effect, prioritizing visa availability rather than first in, first out. So for petitions that have been filed by non-Chinese Vietnamese petitioners, they might be looking at kind of a triple, quadruple whammy situation in terms of job creation and material change.
Yeah. And Ron, you wanted to bring in the issue of substantial compliance into this whole mix also.
Yeah, so that would be like a fourth example with our direct EB-5 restaurant, where we had a situation where we were projecting job creation and we started with 6 employees and we added a 7th and we added an 8th and we added a 9th and we were planning on continuing to expand. But given COVID-19, all those plans are gone. We hope we're going to get back to where we were eventually. Going to take a long time, but we're probably in no foreseeable future will we be bigger than what we were before. So there we don't have 10 positions. We haven't created 10 jobs in the past, but we have substantially complied with the 10 job creation requirements. So that would be a fourth example and how we would argue that.
But isn't this a hard black and white rule? 10 jobs must be 10 jobs. Substantial compliance is not there. It's you can't be partially pregnant.
Yeah, actually, substantial compliance is in the regulations. This is part of the law. Now, it's not defined anywhere as to what substantial means and how close you have to come, but that is in the law.
And this could also be taken to be used in the construction example also, where you're not utilizing the same amount of money, but you substantially complied with what was required for this building.
Yes. So if the result of the fact that the expenditures were significantly less than intended results in Jeff's economic report projecting fewer than the necessary jobs, but close, we would try to argue the substantial compliance. We never want to be in a position where we have to do that.
Yeah,
because
yes.
Unlike everything else where we, you know, in my opinion, we have legal rights to certain things, since there is no exact definition of substantial compliance, we're basically at the mercy of the court.
Right.
So we don't want to be in that position, but it's always good to know what arrows are in the quiver if you need them.
We are getting some really strange type of requests lately. One of the requests that we've been seeing is changing the offering documents to include COVID language, including COVID language in the PPM, as well as perhaps putting it in the operating agreement. I don't know if any of you are seeing this.
We here at EPR see lots of offering documents. And, you know, obviously, it's as drafters of EB-5 project business plans, too, certainly something like COVID would need to be mentioned from a credibility standpoint. And I would imagine after looking at all the offering documents that we all look at, COVID if it is going to be something that could impact an investor's willingness to invest in the project, certainly has to be part of the offering documents.
No, I agree. Well, force majeure is obviously there. That's in, it's in all the PPMs and it's in all, every document. But specific COVID language, that's new. That's brand new. And coming up with the specific, I know that some documents already have it. People have already started including it because they've been emailing us. But anyway, let's move on. One thing that I know is just not nice to talk about, but unfortunately it has been the case, is the death or incapacity of a principal investor, and likewise death or incapacity of an EB-5 project, an essential EB-5 project team member. So Ron, I'm going to ask you first of all, if a petition is in process, I-526 has not yet been approved and the principal investor dies, what then?
Yeah, it depends completely. And so if the concern is what happens to the surviving spouse and the children, and the answer is that actually the petition can be saved even if the investor dies, as long as the surviving spouse was living in the U.S. at the time that the spouse died and is still living in the U.S. Assuming that happens, then under a specific section of the statute of the immigration law, that petition can survive even though the investor is deceased.
Well, that's good to know. Carolyn, what if it's an EB-5 project person, an essential person on the team?
Yeah, gosh, I hope that no one suffers that on the project side and also on the for the investor's sake. I think that each set of facts will be very specific, and that's really going to determine the viability of the project from the standpoint of what role that person played. If that person was at the developer level, you know, the project securities advisor might say that, you know, that's a material fact now that has changed that relates to a key component of the project description, and it may inject more risk into the project. I'm not going to opine on what's required under securities laws, but that might be something that new commercial enterprise managers might want to talk to their securities counsel about. And similarly, you know, if it's a new commercial enterprise manager or regional center principal, you know, that could affect how the project is managed from an EB-5 compliance standpoint going forward. So,
well, I can add there that if on a securities side, that if there's going to be a major change in the team, it wouldn't be considered, I don't believe it would be considered a material change, but you would have to inform all of the investors, and you would have to go through the process of informing the investors. And I'm pretty sure that investors would not drop out just because they'd had to make a major change on the team, but they would have that option. So, here's a question that a lot of investors are very anxious about. I know none of us have a crystal ball here, and it is very difficult to decide, but the projects which are struggling right now, even if they manage to get their green cards and an investor doesn't get the return of capital, which is what they are worrying about. I know we can't say too much about this, but I would like your opinions, team here. Ron, if an investor comes to you and says, I'm really, really worried about my project, I don't think that I'm going to get my money back, can I just pull out my money now and go into a project that I think is going to give me my money back and retain my priority date under COVID? Will that work?
Well, the issue is what stage in the process you're at. So if you pull your money out before the 2 years following your conditional residence, there's going to be a problem with meeting what's called the sustainment requirement for the I-829 approval. If you pull your money out before you even have conditional residence, then you've got an even bigger problem. There is another dividing line, which is if you have an approved I-526 and then you are pulling your money out and investing it in a different project, the good news is that you can keep the priority date for quota purposes, especially if you're from China or Vietnam or India. That's a big deal. But the bad news is you would have to file a new I-526 petition.
One last question for both yourself, Carolyn, and Jeff. Are we going to see more USCIS delays? Because they're not going to get their site visits done during this pandemic. And if they're not going to get their site visits done, perhaps they won't even get on to doing the A29.
I think we're hearing some mixed things. I think by way of customer service, so if anybody needs to actually make contact with USCIS, because they need to make an InfoPass appointment to renew their I-551 stamps. You know, these are issues on the investor side primarily. We're not getting good reports of USCIS responsiveness there. And also NVC, this is not USCIS, but State Department, processing visa applications. I know that regional center compliance reviews are also being delayed as a result. So yes, this could push out A29 adjudications and other benefit adjudications.
Yeah. Are you hearing anything about site visits, Jeff?
I don't think that the USCIS is going to back off on their enforcement and they'll just modify the schedule so they can do the same degree the site visits that they do. I think they find them to be very instructive when they actually go look around and nose around and talk to people. So I think they're going to continue to do them. They'll just move the schedule to accommodate what it is they can do after we get past the really restrictive parts of the social distancing.
Yeah, I happen to agree with you on that. I think that they'll find a way. And at the moment, everything is in lockdown until the middle of May, at least.
And for most projects, Mona, they actually, you know, even though they can be a little intrusive, it's good for them to have a site visit because most projects are doing what they intended to do and it actually helps them.
I agree. And we might actually see something more come up because there has been a lot of talk about the integrity measures coming in if EB-5 is going to be part of the stimulus.
I hope so.
Yeah, me too.
I can almost guarantee that we all feel the same way. Well, Ron Klasko, Carolyn Lee, and Jeff Carr, thank you for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Well, I'm very happy to have been a part of it. It's a very, very important topic. None of us have ever had to deal with what we're dealing with now, so there's no precedent before it, but hopefully we've given the audience some ideas on how to deal with the problems that will inevitably arise.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me again.
I really enjoyed my fourth podcast appearance with Mona.
He's a regular now, Mark.
He is. Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.